Welcome to the Channel States and Migration in Europe. I am Emmanuel Comte. Today we are discussing the topic of Turkey and migration in Europe. My guest today to discuss this is Senem Dizgid. Senem is a professor at Sabancı University in Istanbul. And we have been talking with Senem about the situation in Turkey quite a few times together already, informally. What is the situation in Istanbul, elsewhere in the country? What are the risks also of outflows of migrants from Turkey given the current tension within the country? Inside Europe, there has recently been a debate about the so-called instrumentalization of migrants. This, to be fair, this debate has been more focused on Belarus as soon as there started to be uncontrolled inflows in Belarus, but it very much started in February 2020 when there were migrants crossing the Greek-Turkish border. And this question continued at the Moroccan-Spanish border in Ceuta, and over the last days there have been further tensions in Ceuta. And so, according to this idea of instrumentalization of migrants, there are crises at EU borders because you have third countries trying to manipulate migrants and move them toward the EU. That's definitely the case for Belarus. But for Turkey, the situation is a little bit more complex. So, Senem, could you just give your thought about the migration situation in Turkey? Do you think that a number of migrants has really increased in Turkey? To what extent is it related to EU policies? And how do you see the situation moving forward?
Okay, well, thank you so much, Emmanuel. And thank you so much for inviting me and having me on your program, on your channel. Yes, I mean, let's start with the simple question or the simple answer, which is that indeed the numbers of migrants in Turkey has increased substantially over the last decade, and especially, of course, after 2015 or so. This, of course, is automatically related to the Syrian war. So the Syrian civil war has a lot to do with it. And of course, the EU-Turkey migration deal also has something to do with it. So Europe very much figures in this debate as well. Now, as of today, just to give an idea, the number of Syrian refugees in Turkey amount to around 4 million people, or maybe a little over 4 million people. The Turkish population at large is about 80 million people. So Turkey is a big country, just to sort of to give you a relative sense, right, of the size, especially for people who might be watching this and who might not be so familiar with Turkish politics and society. So we're talking about a large country with a large population, yet hosting a very large number of migrants. Now, the thing about the situation about migration in Turkey is that once the Syrian civil war actually broke out, and once these people started coming to Turkey in large numbers, the idea was that they were guests whom Turkey would host for some time, and then they would be returned to their home once peace was restored in Syria. Now, that was the official narrative. Now, of course, it's been, well, almost a decade, right? Not yet, perhaps 10 years, but we're close to that. And people are seeing that this is not the case, right? Most of these Syrian refugees are here to stay. And because of the migration deal, of course, that most of them will remain in Turkey because there's less pressure on them to move, or there's less there are less ways of them to move into Europe. And so we have to think and talk about this in a different sense of the term, about integration, about long-term prospects of these migrants and how they're going to be integrated in Turkish society, in education, in the workforce, etc., all of that. So they were no longer the guests, right, as it was pointed out to be. Now, of course, once the debate started moving in this direction, it also became increasingly politicized, because, and this is something that we chatted with you, Emmanuel. I remember, as you said at the beginning in our informal chats as well, the fact that this has gradually become more and more politicized issue in Turkey. Politicized in the sense that in the earlier years or days or months, when the Syrian migrants, the Syrian refugees were seen mainly as guests, right? Then this issue wasn't so much picked up by political parties, including, of course, the opposition. There seemed to be rather a positive consensus around the fact that these people had, you know, needed somewhere to go, and that, you know, we could be that host nation and we could sort of lend them a helping hand when they were in need. And, you know, the government justified it on grounds of religion, sort of this religious or ethical duty to respond, you know, to care and all that. And that was kind of bought by a considerable segment of society as well. So this wasn't politicized. It wasn't an issue that was subject to political debate in the sense of political contestation among the government and opposition parties. Now, as this guest narrative has kind of lost out, or it's being replaced by, well, these refugees are here to stay narrative, especially given the state of the deteriorating Turkish economy in the last 1 or 2 years, especially, we have a situation in which the issue of migrants is becoming more and more politicized. That is, opposition parties are bringing them up, and it's become politicized to the extent that there is a completely new opposition party whose only agenda is the migration issue, right? The only issue that they're campaigning on is to send all the migrants back home. And I don't think, you know, they're like a one-issue party. I don't know how much they support they have in society. They're probably still a marginal party if we look at the polls, but they're there. And it just shows that this is now become a very highly political issue. And you see that it is. I mean, this is not happening in a vacuum. This issue is becoming more politicized, contested at the level of political parties, because the level of discontent at the level of the public, societal discontent, is on the rise. And when you look at recent public opinion data, you see that, you know, opposition support party supporters, government party supporters, they hardly converge on anything, except one or two issues, and this is one of them. So there seems to be a negative consensus, if we can put it like that, you know, a negative issue, at least, is an anti-migrant issue, anti-migrant position, which seems to societally bring the opposition party supporters, supporters of opposition parties, and governmental party supporters together, right? And this discontent is at a very, very high rate. So this is the situation that we currently are in with the issue of Syrian migrants, refugees in Turkey today.
Yeah, and
give a snapshot.
Yeah, it rings many bells also with the political debate in other European countries, that the case of Turkey is on the one hand similar, and on the other hand different. It's similar, indeed, as you say, with the politicization of immigration in Turkey. And I am interested in understanding what it is that politicians put forward when they campaign against immigrants. Is it that they are a security threat directly? Is it that their economic access to jobs is scarce and they consider migrants as competitors? Is it related to welfare are migrants accused of benefiting from social welfare? So yeah, these are my question for the similarities with other European debates. And for the differences, we can deal with that later, but the difference is that there is this pressure in Turkey also, at least to some extent, because as you say, this is European policies that have constructed Turkey as a dead end in the migration routes to the West. So that can be an additional factor of problems. But let's start first with the similarities with European political debates. What are the main issues that politicians bring forward?
Okay, great question, Emmanuel, because it got me thinking as you were asking the question, right? I mean, of course, we hear these debates a lot, but I never really thought about it in parallel to the European debates on migrants and migration. You know, it doesn't cross my mind a lot, but now that you ask the question, I see the similarities in many respects. I mean, first of all, of course, the welfare issue, right? The argument that the Turkish economy is already in shambles and these people are getting all kinds of, you know, extra social assistance money from the state. They use our hospitals, they use the state services. There's a lot of pressure on social security system, especially health, because of the migrants, right? So that's, now, by the way, I'm not getting into a discussion about whether this is correct or not. Please don't get me wrong. This is not my personal position, but these are just some of the arguments that are being made, okay? And of course, some of these arguments are made on very false premises or numbers that are just not simply true, but that's another, you know, discussion, right? It's just similar to the European debate in that sense. So you have the welfare argument, you have the economic impact argument that, you know, we have an unemployment problem anyway, so we need to, you know, send them home and make employment for Turks who actually need the jobs. So that's another argument. And believe it or not, there is a cultural and value-based argument as well, in the sense that some argue that these people are just very different to Turkish society, especially in their views on women, for instance. You know, kind of women's liberation dresses, their sort of contribution to society. And some argue that by sort of having these migrants in, the government is using them to change the composition of Turkish society to make it more Middle Eastern or Arabic or whatever, whereas this is against our nature, right? And so there's a debate about culture and identity as well. So in that sense, this is interesting, isn't it? Because you have that debate in Europe, like let's say for migrants, right? Or Turkish, or the Turks, you have that debate for the Syrian refugees or other migrants that come from. I mean, the culture and identity debate recently has taken a turn from Syrian refugees to Afghanis and Pakistanis that come from Afghanistan and Pakistan as well, because Turkey is becoming a kind of a hub for irregular migration, not just you know, from Syria, but you also have people coming from Afghanistan, especially, of course, after, you know, the situation in Afghanistan recently, you know, the United States withdrawal, et cetera, and from Pakistan. And these are usually solitary men, you know, who come to Turkey. So you have these videos of these men doing all kinds of stuff. Yeah. But again, if they're true, they're not true, I don't know. But it's all about stories about sexual harassment or women being, oh, this and that. And the idea that even if you have 2-3 instances, this is a big thing, right? Like this is, you know, how they view women in their countries. And, you know, this is against us and our way of living and that kind of stuff. So way of life. And yeah. Central to it is women, right? So that's a part of the debate as well. So it's not just about the economy. So economy and welfare, yes. But this is also a part of the story, especially for more secular segments of the opposition.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. I have my personal views on how those various questions generally combine and what are the causal effects from one to another. And I think this case backs my view. That is, it seems to me that the cultural factor is generally something that comes after and is part of a narrative of a construction of an issue. And if you take the debates in various European countries, for instance, in France, it's supposed when it comes to culture, it's very often supposed to be all about Islam. And so that the fact that there is this criterion that in France are a Christian country or with Christian roots because it has been secularized, but at least there are this Christian root or a strictly laic country. And those people are religious people and Muslim. This is the ultimate reason why it cannot work and we cannot integrate them. I have always been suspicious with this argument. And I think the arguments get shaky when we observe the situation in Turkey, which is a Muslim country. There are different kinds of practice, of religion, of course, and roles of women can change from one Muslim country to another. But it shows very well that actually you have 100 shades of gray, if I can use this expression.
That absolutely.
You can always find the others different culturally, even when actually you are part of the same religious body. And this is important, I think, for the European public to understand that is even in a country like Turkey, which is primarily a Muslim country, you still have those arguments by politicians about cultural diversity and even religious diversity that makes supposedly integrating immigrants impossible. And so in my understanding, there are two factors. That is, on the one hand, there is some fear in the local population about especially this welfare issue, that is how migrants are taking the welfare, which itself is a product of state policies. And there is also this issue of job competition, but at some point it gets transformed. There is a metamorphosis of the debate, and because also the economic debates can become problematic, we move towards the cultural debate quite mechanically. The economic debate can become problematic because generally migrants are poor, and therefore that's why they could benefit more from welfare system. And so if you stay only in the economic debate, at some point you will say, okay, but these people are poor. So you want to move outside of that because it's unfair to get rid of people simply because they are poor. I don't know any religion that says get rid of the poor. Any religion or any moral code will say we need to help the poor. So because of this problem, there is a necessity to move towards the cultural dimension. And but that's yes. So this is strikingly similar, and I think it does a good job for debunking the cultural argument. But that's my opinion, and Senem, you are perfectly free to have a different view on this. But
I largely agree with you. You know, yesterday I was just reading the news about that horrific event, you know, of migrants, you know, the African migrants who were killed, you know, who were shot by, you know, trying to cross from Morocco to Spain, I think. Did you read those?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tragic event, right? Incident. And I was reading about it in The Guardian and elsewhere. And then I saw on Turkish Twitter that it was circulating. And in some parts of Turkish Twitter, it was like, yeah, wonderful. That's how you protect your borders. So the Europeans are doing the right thing. So, you know.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So when you talk about similarities, or I mean, these things kind of catch on, right? About, you know, this debate about protection of borders, that the border is your, what do they say in Turkish? There was an opposition party leader who used the word, the border is our, not exactly pride, but something like that. I can't find the English word for it, but so, you know, something like very essential to our ethics and to our pride and that kind of stuff, that kind of saying, you know, which is that you need to protect it at all costs kind of discussion. So, you know, they draw parallels, I think, in much of the way. And talking about religious discourse, the government used that religious discourse for a very long time. That was the main discourse that they used to, you know, make this situation acceptable to their constituencies and the public, that, you know, we need to be giving because they are our religious brothers, and so we should help them. They're all Sunni Muslims who are fleeing the, you know, the Shiite, the you know, the horrible barbaric Assad, and the, so that was the kind of the narrative, right? But you see, after a certain point in time, especially with declining economy, it becomes very difficult to sustain that kind of narrative. Because as you said, the Syrians, you know, not all of them, but a vast majority of them are very poor. And they work, for instance, they are highly employed in the Turkish textile industry, right? And these people work for minimal wages with no social security whatsoever, you know, often with minimal benefits, nothing, at the complete luxury of their discretion of their employees. And so there are people, especially big business, that actually seem to, or mid-level business, mostly probably not so big business, that benefit from the situation because it's even cheaper labor, right? So there is a real dimension of economic exploitation that's going on as well, but which is not really, you know, talked about. So it's cloaked in this religious language, but part of it has to do with this economic exploitation of these people, right? So who don't have any labor rights because they might not be registered, right, by the employee or something like that. So you have this kind of situation. So you have a situation in which they seem to fall, you know, even below the lowest working classes now in the Turkish strata. So there is now a fight for jobs, often between them and, again, the working classes of Turkish society, which creates tensions locally at the local levels as well, which is also problematic, right? That's less about identity and culture. That's more about jobs and welfare and whatever, right? Identity, culture, they're also important, but they're discussed by elsewhere. So I hope this clarifies things.
Yeah, yes. So yes, that's a very common pattern. And so you have this economic anxiety in the lower parts of the Turkish working class. And some political entrepreneurs are going to take up this anxiety and those fears and claim that they can protect the lower middle, the lower working class in Turkey from the risks of downward pressure on wages or job scarcity, and so on. And they will also instrumentalize or put forward that at the end of the day, it can be good for the migrants themselves. But actually, what it's about, it's simply to prevent the migrants from taking certain jobs and prevent some forms of economic activity, which in turn can lead to further problems. But you seem to say that currently migrants are employed at very low wages, but they can still work. There are even though I am sure there are many migrants that are out of work. But more broadly, and on this point, as you mentioned, there is a difficult economic situation in Turkey. And I am not an expert of the Turkish economy, but to the best of my knowledge, the Turkish government is not completely foreign to this economic problems. When a country has such a level of inflation, it's generally because the government has conducted quite ill-advised economic policies. And so migrants are useful generally in such cases to cover the failure of government's economic policies and pretend that if there are economic lower wages or economic problems of access to jobs and so on and so forth, it's because migrants are around and they're accepting so low wages and so on. Do you think this is something that is taking place in Turkey now?
The government isn't doing that for the time being, to be fair. The government doesn't adopt that kind of discourse, right? They don't. I mean, I haven't seen any sort of speeches by the president or by people close to him that associate the economic downturn with the migrants. So they don't do that. But the opposition, especially the far right, for instance, that new party that I was mentioning to you, what's it called? It's called Victory Party, I think. And it's like a one-man show. It's headed by this man who was a member of and a high-ranking member of the Nationalist Action Party in previous years, which is an ultra-nationalist Turkish party. And now he formed this sort of splinter anti-migration party, that, which only campaigns on this. So they have that kind of discourse, but the government doesn't do that. But of course, I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, whether the government will do it itself or other parties, or maybe it will instrumentalize other fringe parties to channel that sort of anxiety into the migrants. I don't know. I mean, we are in a situation, Emmanuel, I mean, you just mentioned the state of the Turkish economy. As of now, we have very high rates of inflation, but we haven't had these high rates of inflation in the last 20 years. So this is a new situation compared to the recent last two decades, right? Of course, we've had our share of economic crises in 2001 and in the 1990s, etc. But since the AKP came to power, this is the worst we've been economically in Turkey, right? Inflation is like super up, prices are high. There's not, by the way, we have an inflation problem. So there's an issue about access to resources, but we also have a housing problem, especially in big cities, right? Which have a lot to do with inflation and other things, but it also has to do with the fact, for instance, that the government has sort of is giving out citizenship on the, you know, if you purchase property, et cetera, if you're from a third country, you purchase property for a certain amount of money, they give you citizenship, et cetera. And because of, especially now after the war as well, you have Russian fleeing Russia, you have Ukrainians, so you have sort of new faces in the migration scene too, especially in big cities like Istanbul. And so the property prices remain up. So people are getting extremely anxious and people are extremely angry with that too, right? So it's not just about the economy, they associate the housing prices with the migrants as well, not Syrians in particular, but generally, right? This whole wave of migration. I mean, Turkey, of course, isn't a hub, as I said, when it comes to transit migration or migration because of the geography it's in, right? So you have the Russia-Ukraine war, you have people fleeing from Russia, you have people fleeing from Ukraine, right? So it's like a hub where they can, you know, because Russians can't go to Europe, they come here. You know, Ukrainians, some of them go to Europe, some of them come here. So it depends on their, you know, economic state, geographic proximity, whatever, or connections, all have you. And of course, you have the situation from Asia, you know, and the Middle East. So you have this kind of situation which creates a housing crisis on top of this. So again, the housing crisis isn't, of course, 100% related to this, but, you know, it has a certain part to play in it. And, you know, people are associating it increasingly with at least the migration issue. So the fact that the economy is doing terrible it's doing terrible because the government cannot govern effectively, right? The Turkish economy, they're not doing the things that they should be doing, like raising interest rates and stuff. And that's another discussion. So I'm not going to go into that. Maybe you should discuss that with someone else. But anyhow, but because they are doing that, even though the government isn't, you know, directly associating migration with this, they refrain from doing that. In people's minds, this is increasingly becoming connected. And this, to me, is a problem when you talk about societal cohesion or the prospect of integration, right, in the longer term.
Yes, this is also something that echoes another pattern in European countries, that is, generally, the government will refrain from pointing at migrants directly, unless, you know, you can think of some nearly genocidal governments in other regions that has been taking place. But in most cases in Europe, at least, the governments will not try to point at migrants because the governments try to avoid violence against migrants.
Yeah,
primarily.
Exactly.
Very
violence, events that they can't control, you know?
Yes. They are very concerned about these things. The opposition may be less concerned about this problem, and that would explain what you say, that the opposition apparently has no intention of of disputing the policies that have created such a dire economic situation, and as a result, they are more likely to refer even implicitly to migrants as at the root of the problem. So, so it seems to me that there are many, many similarities, and it's very interesting between the Turkish case and Europe. That is, on the one end, you have this cultural narrative that is migrants are different from us culturally, even if we are talking here about Muslim migrants in a Muslim country. I think that's very interesting to keep in mind for European citizens who follow this question. There is also some form probably of covering the dire economic situation by reference even implicitly to migrants, more probably on the side of the opposition than on the side of the government, who is itself concerned about uncontrolled outburst of violence. But let's try to move on now that we have discussed a little bit more the internal situation within Turkey. And let's move on to what role Turkey has in Europe today, because Turkey is not a random country. Actually, Turkey has turned into the last years in a major actor in the EU system of migration control. As you mentioned at the beginning, the EU-Turkey statement of March 2016 was really the turning point that ended the so-called migration crisis at Europe's borders in 2015 and 2016. So the EU and its member states have relied increasingly on Turkey to keep migrants out. So it's very interesting to compare the rising tension around immigration in Turkey and the role that the Europeans have given to Turkey. And so what strikes me in this context, and you will tell me, Sinem, what you think about that, is that from the European point of view, the dominant analysis seems to be that if there are tensions at the Greek-Turkish border or the Bulgarian-Turkish border, it must be because the Turkish government is trying to blackmail the EU in one way or another. I mean, you hear this narrative very much. So it's more applied to Belarus, of course. It has been applied to Morocco as well, but it's very much also present in relation to Turkey. And so this is particularly unfair given the situation in Turkey. And so do you think that to some extent EU policies using Turkey as a gatekeeper of in Europe has contributed to this tension around migration in Turkey? What are your views on this?
Yes.
Tricky
yes.
question.
I mean, I think, you know, it's really, the answer is straightforward, and the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, Emmanuel, I think we have to be frank here, right? Be honest, take a step back and think about a situation when any European country ends up with 4 million refugees on its soil, right? It's a big thing. It could bring down governments. It could create societal unrest. It could even fuel violence, God forbid, right? At the worst case scenario. So even though Turkey is a big country, 80 million, whatever, 4 million people, 4 million refugees, or maybe more now, I don't know, 5, whatever, is a lot for any country to integrate, right? And the EU, of course, just went through this policy of, you know, giving them money and then just letting them be, right? Whether Turkey is a safe country, whether it's ethical or legal for these people to stay here, what they do, none of it concerns the European Union, right? Or at least that's the attitude that's been displayed in the policies. So the idea in the part, in the eyes of the Turkish people, is that now, as you know, the deal is becoming more politicized and it's becoming more politically contested, the European Union is also entering the discussion increasingly so as well, right? So people who weren't so much aware of EU involvement in this migration issue are now becoming more aware, okay? And they're saying, aha, the EU has something to do with this situation because they're the ones who just, you know, give us money and for a negligible amount, as long as, you know, we keep a certain number of people at bay and away from Europe, and that they're treating us like a buffer zone. So it really doesn't work well, or doesn't work well for the EU's general image across Turkish society, across Turkish opposition parties, etc. So this is how the EU is increasingly viewed. Now, of course, by the way, having mentioned opposition parties, let me just open a parenthesis here as well in response to something you said, because I think this is important to note. Not all of the opposition parties have a very anti-migrant stance, right? There are now more fringe extreme right party, for instance, that has a super anti-migrant sort of position. Some sort of previously sort of, you know, Islamist splinter parties from AKP who seem to be much more moderate. And you have the main opposition party who is sort of less, I would say, emotional when it comes to this migration issue, but talks about sending some of them back, etc., suggesting a few policies here and there. So there is a variety, you know, with the variance across the opposition parties on how they approach the issue as well, right? So I think I'll have to make that clear. So, but the vision of Europe is, yes, I mean, the idea is very negative. And on the part of, you know, this issue becoming being used as for leverage, which is what you said, is yes. I mean, in the past, Erdogan tried to use it as leverage. You might remember this was just before COVID, when I think around 34 Turkish soldiers were killed in northern Syria. And of course, you probably know that Turkey has long been calling for cooperation or EU cooperation and building a sort of a safe zone in Syria, right? And that it felt largely left alone. And as a response to that, the response of the government at the time was to just open the borders, right? So they were just sending people on buses to the border, you know, just you can go wherever you go. But of course, what happened? So it has been done in the past, of course, not maybe in the way that Belarus did, but, you know, something similar, right? Now, and at the time, what happened, of course, is that the EU just pushes back, right? So it doesn't let these people in, and it shows certain kind of solidarity in this pushback policy. You might remember the Commission president came to Greece, Ursula von der Leyen, so they gave this, I think Charles Michel even, they gave this kind of united front that we're not going to cave in, so, you know, Greece won't admit any new migrants and that kind of stuff. And so what happened is that it was a kind of a tragedy with these people stuck in between, like for days. And that was it, and that was the incident. So I think, I mean, that incident also went to show that even if there is going to be a human tragedy at the end, hopefully that tragedy wasn't that big in that on that specific instance, that they're not going to back it, you know, they're not going to back down. And I think so that it doesn't mean that Turkey still doesn't have any leverage. It does have leverage over the migration issue because obviously things could escalate further. But that it's not so easy to use and you might not always get immediate results from that. I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, the leverage is not just about, you know, sending migrants or opening the gates whenever they need to. It's also about the fear in Europe that this is a possibility, right? Because the moment that this starts becoming discussed in Europe, we know that, you know, that's when, for instance, these far-right parties, those political parties who campaign on an anti-migration front, you know, they pick up from this, they feed from this. And this is always a problem for the center parties, center right, center left, you know, mainstream political parties that want to avoid that kind of discussion, that want to avoid that issue, right? So I think it's that kind of leverage that Turkey has. And I think this is the one of the reasons as to why, for example, the EU has been turning a blind eye to many things happening in Turkey since the migration deal, including, you know, the regime change, about all kinds of things about Turkish domestic governance, which normally the EU would be very critical about, but they kind of, it's kind of an, I would say, a tacit agreement for Europe turning a blind eye and in return for Turkey sustaining the migration deal.
Yes,
that's how I see it. But you see, but that's how people increasingly see it as well. And that doesn't fare well for the EU's image in Turkey. And for people who've been working on Europe and who are in favor of the European integration project, even personally, like myself, have an issue with that.
Yes, so Turkey is such an important partner to manage migration flows in Europe that it leads European policymakers to tune down possible possible criticisms they would make of Turkey more broadly, as you say, but also even in the field of migration policies. But there are still been these criticisms of instrumentalization of migrants and so on and so forth. But it's easy for Erdogan to instrumentalize migrants because he's he has such a situation at home that it's very easy to send those people west. It doesn't imply a lot of effort. There is so much pressure within Turkey. I mean, with very little effort, you can incite those people to move westwards. And likewise, you mentioned the opposition wants to send those migrants back home. They may at some point realize that it will be easier to send them westwards than to send them back home, where they definitely don't want to return, given the situation in Syria or in Afghanistan. So my view on this is that these immigration restrictions are presented as very often presented as policies of free deliberation by democracies. That is, they have the right, any country has the right to control its border and control who can enter and so on and so forth. But in practice, those policies, first of all, rely on the cooperation of other countries. And second, those policies may create a difficult situation in other countries, so that the idea of a possibility of unilateralism in the field of migration policy is a myth. You need to cooperate with other countries. So in practice, as you say, European policymakers are aware of that in relation to Turkey, but in the debate, in the political debate, this aspect is generally neglected. And so how do you deal with the fact that other countries that are important to implement policies that you consider your own right to implement do not play by your rule? How do you deal with that? And what we can see increasingly is this criticism of instrumentalization. And here you will point to the fact that you will criticize the political regime, you will criticize Erdogan, you will criticize Morocco. And at the end of the day, you make those countries responsible for the negative externalities that your policies have also initiated. And this is a serious problem, because it can lead to an escalation of international tensions. So like in domestic politics, you have politicians that are going to more or less implicitly refer to migrants to cover up economic problems. In international politics, you will have politicians that will more or less point to foreign governments to cover up the failure of their own policies. So once you enter the path of immigration restrictions, you create increasing tensions, and that's why this kind of policies may not be sustainable in the long run. So what do you think about the prospects now. Do you think that the opposition you mentioned has reasonable chances to get to power in the near future? Or do you see that in one way or another, Turkey is going to change policy and this may result in more clashes with the European Union with potential destabilizing effects in other areas of policymaking?
Thank you, Emmanuel. I mean, you're absolutely right in the sense that if you choose externalization as the major policy for migration management into your borders, then of course these are the risks that you take, right? These third countries using this as a leverage or trying to attract certain concessions or wanting to, cooperate on more equal grounds, all that kinds of stuff. So you will have to somehow account for those. I mean, it's the same with, like Mexico and US. And I mean, it's not just about Europe. This is what happens when you have these kind of transit agreements with states and how they work. So, but of course, the thing here is, in the Turkish case, if you look at the opposition today, there are various mixed voices about how they're going to deal with this issue. Now, most of the opposition parties agree that this situation is unsustainable, okay? So it has to change. But the suggestions sometimes that they come up for changing this policy is not very realistic. So one is left wondering whether any of their policy proposals in this field are actually feasible, right? They're implementable. Now, what are these? For instance, if you look at that far-right fringe parties, what do they say? We're going to send all the migrants back. Kick them out, right? If they don't want to go, we'll put them on buses. Who cares? Who has the right to say anything, right? Who has the high moral ground in this world? Europeans? No. No one will care. We'll just send them. Can you do that? Well, in theory, you can, right? But in practice, how would that look? And what's the degree of pressure or violence that you would have to use to get millions of people kicked out is a big question. Whether Assad would be happy receiving all these Sunnis who sort of fled his administration in the first place is another question, right? So there are big question marks as to whether this is in fact doable. But of course, people don't really look into this. I mean, larger society doesn't look at it whether it's doable or not. Some of them just buy the argument that, let's just keep them out, whatever it takes, okay? So there is a reception for that. That's what I'm trying to say. Now, if you look at the main opposition, which of course more credible parties, they're sort of, at least in terms of the prospect of coming to power, they also claim that this is not sustainable. And they say, well, we're going to sit down with Assad, and we're going to agree with them on a returns policy. Doable in theory, but in practice, what are the percentage of those Syrians in Turkey who actually want to return to Syria? 15 or so. I haven't done the research, but I've read some people who have done the research, and they're around 15%, okay, 15, maximum 20, I don't know, right? And the longer the time span expands, of course, the lower this figure will be, given that people get settled in an area. Their children go to school, they sort of have a certain, living environment or jobs or whatever. Once you're settled, you don't want to be dislocated once again back to a country which is very different from when you were there in the first place, right? And you migrate. So again, they say that that's what they're going to do, but that's very problematic. Another thing, of course, that some of them mention, which I think is more realistic, and this is where perhaps more cooperation with Europe could be or should be sought, is the issue of integration, right? I mean, I think it's becoming more and more obvious that Turkey will, even if the opposition wins, it now has a considerable, a sizable migrant population who are here to stay, right? So the big question is, how can you make sure that this migrant population is integrated successfully enough to the extent that they can take part in a sort of a productive way in the workforce, that they can, you know, fully be integrated into the schooling system. They speak the language, they write it. You see what I mean? That they, you know, give back to society, and this is somehow managed within society. I think this is the big question. Because what the government did is that the deal with the EU was done. The EU said nothing about integration, nothing substantive anyway. And it was all about numbers and limiting the numbers and the money, right? And the government took that option, happy with the leverage that it gave them, and did very, very little, almost nothing in the way of long-term integration, right? So this is where the problem really stems from. And this is where so many of people's grievances and resentment is coming from, okay? Because they feel that there is this problem and the government has done nothing to address it, even though it's been years. And the EU has done nothing to push for it, because as long as people don't come, the EU seems to be okay with it. So for the EU, it's all about mobility, right? The mobility aspect of it, rather than actually integration and people living together and all that kind of stuff. So I think that would be a challenge for the near future in case the opposition does come to power. And I think they do have a good chance of coming to power. At least that's what the polls are, all of the polls are telling us today. And as the economy deteriorates, unfortunately, it looks like it will deteriorate further. The government will lose further support. So day by day, it's becoming increasingly likely that the opposition will come to power in Turkey in next year's elections, right? If, of course, they don't hold early elections later this year. We don't know that yet. So in case that comes, I think Europe should be ready to reopen the package of migration, including the deal, and discussing that with the opposition parties, because any opposition party that's in government will want to renegotiate that. I'm kind of quite certain of it.
Right, yes.
But whether EU is ready for that, I don't think so. For them, whenever I speak to European policymakers, sorry, I'm speaking a little bit informal here maybe, but to me it's a puzzle, because I always have a feeling that they just leave things to time. This is not just about relations with Turkey or migration. This is, I mean, you know, you're a scholar of European studies. This is for many policy areas. Like, yeah, we'll think about it when the time comes, right? When push comes to shove. So no need to prepare for it right now. But when the push does come to the shove, it will happen very quickly. So I think there's always merit in having a bit of preparation about what is increasingly likely to come in the next year or so.
Yes, that's something I definitely agree with. That is, in terms of migration policies and when it comes to restrictions, there are incoherences with which politicians are not ready to deal with. And so at some point, those incoherences will kick in one way or another. And given the turn of the migration debate in Europe, I wouldn't be surprised if the day when the opposition in Turkey, as you say, tries to renegotiate the deal between the EU and Turkey, I wouldn't be surprised if you have major political parties in Europe saying that, blaming Turkey for this, that is blaming the new Turkish government, putting forward that in one way or another they are authoritarian, or supposedly the Turkish population would not be willing to follow this path, and so on and so forth. And so you would have an escalation of violence, or at least rhetorical violence between the two sides. And here you see how restrictive policies can, because they are inconsistent, because they rely on other countries, because they put burden on other countries, create a tension. And those at the origin of those policies will never admit that their policies have contributed to this situation. And if Turkey doesn't want to play by the rule, it's because it's an authoritarian country one way or another. So you start blaming the others for the failure of your policies. And this is a mechanism that leads to increasing government intervention, increasing, for instance, control at the border, investment over the border, and international tensions in a region of the world which is already extremely tense. So I think it was interesting, Senem, to have this conversation and to see how migration control can spill over in international conflicts, which we may have maybe in the next month, and which are definitely nearby. All right, Senem, thank you so much for sharing your very precious insights. I learned a lot personally with all that you say, and I hope that we will learn more about the situation within Turkey, also inside Europe. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Senem?
No. Thank you so much for having me over, and it was a pleasure to chat with you, Emmanuel. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.